have about four or five nurses that we've sent from the state. I have about three nurses here locally that are working on going into the out in the, possibly the next wave.
Alaskans volunteer to help the recovery effort in Texas. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, Labor Day, September 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a wind farm owner sues to force Golden Valley Electric to buy more wind power.
That's what's been missing in all of this is competition. You know, if Golden Valley had had competition for the last 20 years, I can bet they would be doing a lot better job than they're doing right now.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Red Cross is mobilizing volunteers nationwide, including in Alaska, to assist with the response to Tropical Storm Harvey caused flooding in and around Houston, Texas.
This is a disaster on the same scale as Katrina.
Far North Interior Alaska District Red Cross Director Lori Wilson is referring to Hurricane Katrina in 2005, during which 200 Alaskans deployed to Louisiana to help with flood rescue and recovery. That's nearly all of the volunteers the Alaska Red Cross currently has. Wilson says a few Alaskans are already heading to Texas, with more going south on a daily basis.
The biggest thing that they're calling for is nurses, mental health, and shelter workers. We are getting calls from professionals. We have about four or five nurses that we've sent from the state. I have about three nurses here locally that are working on going into possibly the next wave, and then more people calling in as well.
The Red Cross is holding trainings in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau to get volunteers ready to deploy to Houston area flood refugee shelters. Wilson says that includes a course for new volunteers to learn the basics.
How we run our shelters, what we do, what our rules are, make sure the people in the shelter are safe, that their privacy is protected, and that they have what they need.
Wilson emphasizes it takes about 2 weeks for new volunteers to get processed to deploy, cautioning that the following two-week assignments to Houston will be challenging. Wilson says the Red Cross covers all volunteers' travel and expenses while they are deployed. She notes there will be a lot of opportunities to help, given that the immediate disaster response will be followed by a long recovery that the Red Cross will be involved in. An Alaska man accused of contributing to a public health emergency on the Kenai Peninsula from selling synthetic marijuana has been sentenced to 5 years and 10 months in prison. Soldotna resident Philip Nealon was sentenced Friday after pleading guilty to charges related to selling synthetic marijuana or spice and possessing a firearm in furtherance of drug trafficking. Nealon was arrested in December 2015 after multiple agencies raided his business and found about 6,000 packets of synthetic marijuana. Officials say the Kenai Peninsula epidemic essentially stopped after Nealon's arrest. Alaska has had a turbulent relationship with a volatile substance. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says more than 1,300 people were transported to Anchorage hospitals because of synthetic pot between July 2015 and March of 2016. Meanwhile, Alaska made nearly $600,000 in July on marijuana tax, which is equal to about 33% of the total marijuana tax revenue brought in last fiscal year. The Juneau Empire reported July's figures are the highest to date for Alaska's young marijuana industry, which began selling over-the-counter last year in October. Alaska's last fiscal year that ended July 30th saw $1.7 million from the marijuana industry. The state reported 612 pounds of marijuana bud and 369 pounds of stems or leaves were sold in July. The state collects $50 per ounce of bud and $15 per ounce for trimmings. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has approved an air quality attainment plan for Fairbanks. EPA Region 10 Air and Waste Office Director Tim Hamlin highlights state and borough-developed plan measures aimed at reducing local pollution from wood and coal burning.
So the good news about the moderate plan is that it has incentives for residents to replace old high-polluting wood heaters with certified stoves, prohibiting dense smoke from chimneys, and prohibiting the use of unseasoned wood. There are also bans in place that go into effect on using wood heat, depending on the air pollution levels. So we saw those as all good steps moving in the right direction.
Hamlin cautions that the measures have not sufficiently curtailed wintertime fine particulate pollution levels in a portion of the Fairbanks and North Star borough, which was recently redesignated as a serious non-attainment area. Fine particulate levels in that area continue to register the worst in the nation. And Hamlin says its redesignation requires a new plan with more stringent controls, which the borough has already begun to act on.
And the borough's more recently adopted curtailment ordinance, which sets a lower threshold for when burn bans will take place, is the sort of thing we expect to see in a serious plan.
Hamlin says the serious plan requires the borough to work with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation and the borough to analyze and select additional steps. Borough Air Quality Manager Nick Zarnecki says the serious designation requires adherence to a higher standard.
With the moderate plan, we had to go through what's called RACM, or the reasonably available control measures. And with the serious SIP, we have to go through the BACM, which are the best available control measures. And right now, where we're at in the process is we're compiling all of the different control measures for PM2.5 areas across the nation. And we're looking at how the control measures stack up to what Fairbanks currently has.
Zarnecki says additional controls will then undergo technical and economic feasibility reviews, noting that while the borough has to follow a legal framework, it also is working to get new controls in place as soon as possible to clean up the air, emphasizing there are no silver bullet solutions short of an affordable alternative to wood heating. Zarnecki says the borough and state will not likely meet a December deadline for getting the new air plan to the EPA. Fairbanks wind power developer Mike Kraft took Golden Valley Electric Association to court last week, claiming the utility is violating state and federal law by refusing to buy more electricity generated by a Delta Junction area wind farm. Kraft turned to the courts after 4 years of fighting with Golden Valley and working with state regulators to adopt federal policies intended to promote greater use of renewable energy. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Anchorage Superior Court Judge Aaron Marston is deliberating over arguments presented Tuesday by lawyers representing Golden Valley and Alaska Environmental Power, or AEP, which operates a 2-megawatt wind farm near Delta. Teresa Klemmer argued the case for AEP.
They have challenged the tariff filing by Golden Valley Electric Association that establishes the terms and conditions for interconnecting with these small renewable energy companies.
AEP got its day in court to challenge Golden Valley's terms and conditions. After a 4-year effort to get the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to adopt rules modeled after a 1978 federal law that seeks to promote greater use of renewable energy. It began when AEP petitioned the commission in August 2013 to develop state rules that align with the Federal Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, or PURPA.
PURPA was designed to encourage private sector development, specifically with renewables, but any kind of energy development.
Kraft, a developer who made his fortune in Fairbanks before building his first wind farm in Delta in 2009, says PURPA also encourages innovation through competition.
And that's what's been missing in all of this is competition. You know, if Golden Valley had had competition for the last 20 years, I can bet they would be doing a lot better job than they're doing right now.
The commission agreed to consider the request, and after more than 2 years of numerous proceedings involving industry, interest groups, and others, it adopted regulations that went into effect in March of 2016. The next month, Golden Valley filed a tariff it said complied with the new rules, but Kraft and Klemmer disagreed, claiming they're, quote, grossly noncompliant, and they filed objections to the tariff. 3 months later, after some more back and forth over the issue, AEP appealed to the Superior Court.
We think of it as judicial review of an administrative agency decision. That's sort of the category of litigation that it is.
Clemmer says most of Tuesday's oral arguments concerned Golden Valley's motion to dismiss the case or send it to a federal court. She says she's not sure when Judge Marston will reach a decision, but she suspects it'll take a while.
The pace of this case so far has been quite slow. It's been over a year since the notice of appeal was originally filed, and we're just now having our first hearing.
Meanwhile, AEP is pressing Golden Valley in another case before the Regulatory Commission over Kraft's request in December to connect a second wind farm he proposes to build in Delta with the grid. Golden Valley filed a tariff in response to Kraft's request on behalf of the new company formed to manage the project called Delta Wind Farm. Clemmer filed objections to that tariff and asked the commission to reject it. In April, the commission did just that, siding with Delta Wind Farm on, among other things, its objection to Golden Valley's denial of the wind farm's request to connect to the grid. Golden Valley President and CEO Corey Borgeson says that decision was based on the expense of having to back up or regulate wind power with Golden Valley's oil and diesel-fired generators.
Because our cost of regulation is so high, we wouldn't be able to pay Delta Wind anything.
The matter is now under review by Deborah Brandwine, an administrative law judge who works for the commission. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new Stuyahok teenager teaches himself multiple languages.
I try to speak it every day. I have different friends, different nationalities. I speak to them, I guess, through text every day.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The results of Alaska's new standardized tests show more than half of the state's elementary and high school students are not proficient in math, science, and English. The Juneau Empire reports figures indicate 68% of students were rated below proficient or far below proficient in math, 61.6% of students were in those two categories in English, and 53.5% were in those two categories in science. Department of Education spokeswoman Erin Harden says the figures were supposed to be released to the public Friday morning, but computer problems prevented that. Alaska tests students in the spring on their math and English skills in each grade from 3rd through 10th. Science tests are administered only 3 times during that period. Alaskans will continue developing technical skills like welding and dental therapy across the state with the signing of House Bill 141. Last week in Bethel, local high school students surrounded Governor Bill Walker as he penned the legislation into law at the YK Delta's Adult Workshop Workforce Development Center, Utlet Navet. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur was there and brings us this report.
Governor Walker hands out about a dozen of the blue pens used to sign the bill to students from the Kuskokwim Learning Academy. The high school gives him a present in return.
Oh, thank you so much.
A purple and gold KLA t-shirt and water bottle.
Thank you.
Many of these students are already benefiting from this legislation and entering technical programs that meet job needs of local organizations. The bill reauthorizes the Technical Vocational Education Program for another 3 years, putting nearly $12 million towards technical job training. Over $1 million of that will go to Utlet Navet in Bethel.
We do dental health aid therapy, nursing programs, commercial driver's license training.
Dennis DeShawn is Ute's executive director.
Welding training, construction, carpentry, electrical.
Ute is receiving about 10% less funding than in past years. To cover the difference, the center is cutting cost. It has put out fuel services for bid and has been merging barge orders.
Are there going to be any less classes available or any staff positions affected?
Nope, we're trying not to have any effect in the end delivery service.
In fact, the center has twice as many students, about 350, signed up for technical training than ever before. Much of that is made possible by partner agencies, like the Lower Kuskokwim School District and the Association of Village Council Presidents, who recruit workers and sponsor trainings to fill their job needs, like mechanics. What Utlitnavet provides to the YK Delta, the Norton Sound region receives from the Northwestern Alaska Career and Technical Center.
Also known as NACTEC in Nome.
Doug Walrath is the director. One of the most immediate impacts he's seen from the program is rising high school graduation rates. Less than a decade ago, that rate was about 30%.
As more and more students have gotten exposed to it, our graduation rates climbed into the 40, 50, 60, 70, as high as 84%.
The University of Alaska system receives most of the bill's funding. Mary Pete directs Bethel's Kuskokwim University campus. Part of the money will train CNAs, Certified Nurse Assistants, for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation.
We can't seem to produce enough CNAs for them. They get hired, and then some leave the region.
To work at other health centers or move on to nurse training programs. Representative Zach Fansler of Bethel sponsored the bill. It aligns with the Innovation Caucus that he co-chairs and helped found this session. To end the signing, Fansler, along with the governor, lieutenant governor, and multiple commissioners, after much prodding from teachers, joined the high school students in a Yupik moose hunting dance. It took four rounds, but they finally shot the moose, just as the season is beginning. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
A rock slide near Skagway's largest cruise ship dock in late August didn't injure anyone, but it drew attention to the potential danger of an active slide area neighboring a bustling port. KHNS's Emily Files spoke with the private company that owns the dock and monitors the hazards of the cliff next to it.
The dock adjacent to the slide area is called the Railroad Dock. It's owned and operated by the White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad, a major tourist attraction. The railroad has a train track running down the dock that picks up passengers and takes them on scenic rides. Towering on the east side of the dock is a steep cliff prone to landslides. On August 25th, it rained close to half an inch in Skagway. The next morning, at about 6:30 a.m., a rock slide occurred. Two ships, the Volendam and Island Princess, had just tied up to the dock. Tyler Rose is an official with White Pass.
We made the decision to move the ships out of an abundance of care and safety.
The ships were relocated to Skagway's other two cruise docks. Meanwhile, White Pass reviewed the damage. Rose says it was minimal. A large rock struck and damaged a railing meant to protect the facility. Rose says in addition to cleaning up the debris, White Pass had geotechnical engineers assess the slide area. White Pass already has fences on the cliff and a catchment in place to shield the dock from slides.
They've done the assessment and basically said that the catchment or the fencing at the upper level served its purpose, that the excessive rains were a large causation, that what did escape through, that there was obviously an escape through that came through, and they're going to, the initial analysis was that everything appears to be fine.
Rose says the engineers gave the green light for ships to continue tying up at the rail dock. He says White Pass expects to receive more information from the engineers about whether they should implement additional protections.
As you can see by the infrastructure that's been put in the area, we are monitoring it constantly. And we will do what is best to address the safety issues down there, because safety is paramount to our organization.
Scott Hahn is Skagway's borough manager.
It has raised our attention to this issue.
He says he's been approached by some assembly and community members with concerns about the rock slide. Hahn says he would need direction from the assembly as a whole to seek a second opinion on the stability of the slide area. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Most high schoolers take classes in a second language at some point during their high school career with varying degrees of success. One Bristol Bay polyglot took it to another level. This 18-year-old learned four languages fluently before graduation. KDLG's Avery Lill has the story.
Bristol Bay Mirarunga, Chinese Mandarin.
In English, that's Jalen Kanukpiak. He's from New Stuyahok. He graduated from Mount Edgecombe High School in May. Before graduating, he learned to speak Russian, Inupiaq, Yupik, and Tagalog fluently. He's learned to write and speak phrases in Mandarin, Tlingit, Aleutic, Yunnan, Romanian, and Greek. Kanukpiak is Russian Orthodox, and his faith is a key factor behind his drive to learn languages.
And the first Russian missionaries to come to Alaska was simply for me. I always wanted to follow their example of when you go to a region, you are to be a guest. And from there on, I started to learn their customs, their language. And that's what, you know, kind of made me get to know a lot of people.
English is his first language, Yupik his second. Kanukpiak's grandmother taught him her native language when he was 4 years old. At 8 years old, he began to learn Russian to better understand the Russian Orthodox liturgy and teachings. By a mix of school classes, conversation with friends, and practice with the computer program Rosetta Stone, Kanukpiak has picked up a few others as well.
Chinese, because we're great trading partners with China, I guess. Tagalog, when I was attending Mount Edgecombe High School, there was a lot of Filipino residential aides, so I kind of wanted to learn the language just so I know what was going on.
He learned some Tlingit, Aleutic, Yunnan, Romanian, and Greek for church prayers and music. He's gotten to put the languages to use among family and friends and in more public settings. Kanukpiak was the Bristol Bay Area Youth Representative for the First Alaskans Institute in 2015. That year, he had the chance to use the Alaska Native languages he's learning at the Alaska Federation of Natives Elders and Youth Conference. Over the years, Kanukpiak has developed daily habits to help him maintain vocabulary and fluency.
I try to speak it every day. I have different friends, different nationalities. I speak to them, I guess, through text every day. Keeps the language there, like, you know, 15, 30 minutes a day.
This fall, Kanukpiak is attending the University of Alaska Anchorage to study either small business administration or accounting. For him, learning languages is a way of connecting. As he meets more people of diverse backgrounds in his new community, he's looking forward to putting the language skills he's cultivated to work. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Southeast Alaska tribes celebrated recently when a Seattle couple donated back a 100-plus-year-old sacred Chilkat robe. KTOO's Trip Krause learned how the robe made its way home and why it's significant.
Drumming, dancing, and telling stories over an afternoon, representatives from three Southeast Alaska tribes celebrate the return of their Chilkat blanket. Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian members held a homecoming ceremony in the Shuka-Hit clan house in Juneau. But this story of the robe doesn't begin here. For more than 20 years, the sacred object hung on the wall in the Seattle home of Bruce and Gretchen Jacobson. Gretchen says her husband bought the blanket from a store in Seattle's Pioneer Square.
And Bruce saw the blanket robe and he fell in love with it and brought it home.
Although Bruce Jacobson said the couple had the robe authenticated, not much is known about its history before he bought it. One of their daughters, Sarah, was reading an art history textbook and found a picture of a Chilkat robe. Recognizing the similarities between the picture and the robe that hung on her family's wall, she began researching. When Sarah learned of its sacred ceremonial significance, She insisted the family was trespassing on traditional Native culture. The couple reached out to the University of Washington's Burke Museum. Later, they contacted Rosita Worrell at the Alaska Heritage Institute, where they eventually donated the robe. The couple came to Juneau as guests of the homecoming ceremony. Commenting on the story of the blanket, several speakers say that the family is integrated into the story of the robe forever. That's something that stuck with Gretchen Jacobson.
I think one person had said that, looked at the robe and said, the weave is just representative of how everyone is connected and everyone's related and we're all part of the whole picture, and it was a beautiful thing.
Yale Nowu, Joe Zuboff, calls for the spirits of the Chilkat robe to come home.
Tonight I tried to put in some back the spirit that everything we believe, everything has a spirit. Today is a big part of our history now, so part of the history on that blanket that returned is a happy history that comes back. So
Zuboff represents Raven House in Angoon. He's also a caretaker for the Ra'u'u, or sacred clan objects. Many Southeast Alaska Natives believe that their sacred objects are imbued with the spirits of their ancestors associated with the items. Tlingit elder and artist Ken Kotanik, Paul Marks, thinks those ancestors had a role influencing Sarah Jacobson.
What took place today is as if our ancestors returned home to us. And the way it appears and sounds like to me is that the young lady who talked to her mom and dad, she heard the voice of our ancestors and that the blanket wanted to come back home.
Chilkat weavers hope to study the robe to learn how it was made. In Juneau, I'm Trip J. Krause.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Emily Files in Haines, Avery Lill in Dillingham, and Trip Krause in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, celebrating 40 years of production in Prudhoe Bay and support for the Alaska communities where BP employees live and work. Learn more about how BP gives back to local communities at bp.com/Alaska.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.